I believe it's just getting up every day and doing it. But one of the things I do that I'm very strong about in my training is I don't listen to music. I believe music can be a crutch. Very cliche, I know, but it allows me that when the training gets hard or the day is hard, I don't lean on something else. Like, oh, I don't have my music today. I can't get through it mentally, you know? So when I'm out there and I'm doing something and it really is bad, then it's easy for me to get through it with no music. But then every now and then you can kick the music on and it's like, oh, okay, well, this becomes so much easier now because I train with no music.
Well, for me, I go into these adventures just, I don't know. I talk myself into it's just going to suck every single day. I just prepare myself to, you know, I'm not going in with illusions of grandeur that every day we're going to see miraculous sights and I'm going to feel great. So, you know, I go in with a very pessimistic attitude. And then when I do see the great things, the amazing things, you know, it's just icing on the cake. And, you know, it just, it's a routine. It's just like going to work every day. You know, you wake up and some days you're looking forward to going to work. Other days you're going, oh God, do I got to go into work again? And it's like that for me. And I'm going to have a little bit of a benefit over Dustin is that he's been to all these places except for Australia and New Zealand. But every single thing I see is going to be new and exciting to me. So.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guests this week are Dustin Johnson and Brian Hoover. Brian is a returning guest. Brian has been on the show twice before, episode 12 and episode 28, talking about his adventures of van life, as well as hiking the Pacific Coast Trail and kayaking the entire Mississippi. He is going to be supporting Dustin on his attempt to be the seventh person to be certified to have run the circumference of the entire world. Now, you can't run across the oceans, and so the Guinness Book of World Records will not certify an exact round the world record. But Dustin and Brian are going to run the distance. There's a place, something called the World Runners Association, that is will certify the distance for them to run the circumference of the world on various continents, and it counts as an around-the-world record. There are only six people who have been certified before. Dustin's working to become the seventh, and they're going to be working to also be the first American and looking to set the record for the fastest time. This will be Dustin's second attempt to do this, so he has a little bit of experience. He got sidelined by COVID in his first attempt. He's going back for it again, and so good stories from the road and what he's going to experience. And here is my conversation with Dustin Johnson and Brian Hoover. Welcome to the show, Dustin and Brian.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Now, Brian, I was trying to remember today as I was thinking about this. I know you've been the guest that's been the most returns to the show I couldn't remember if you had come back once or twice, but
I think twice. Once after the PCT and once after the Mississippi River. So
okay, yeah. So it's two times, and I was trying to remember. So this is your third. I was trying to remember if we had done three or whether this would be your third. So
yeah, third.
And then Dustin, Brian was the one that kind of got me connected with you, and I read a little bit about what you're doing. Yep. So anyway, I and. Since since you guys are just kind of starting out on this venture, I want to give you each a chance to kind of introduce yourself. Usually I just do a single guest. And so I'm still trying to decide, okay, how am I to work this with two different stories? So Brian, I'm going to start with you. I mean, I'll probably try to link the episode of your past episodes if people want to hear your story more in detail, but kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of who you are and kind of what you're about.
Yeah. So, well, I'm a 54 old man, especially next to this young buck here. I got into running and I've done a lot of trail running and ultras and stuff like that. I've kind of not been a runner so much for the last 6 or 7 years, but so I got into running and then I got into hiking, and in 2019 I did what's called the Pacific Crest Trail that goes from the Mexican border to the Canadian border through California, Oregon, and Washington. And I had so much fun on that, I conned some friends into doing the kayaking the Mississippi River from where it starts in northern Minnesota to the Gulf of Mexico. And I was just kind of in between challenges, and Dustin's mom actually was what it called a river angel. She helped us out on the Mississippi River near St. Louis, where these guys live. And she knew that Dustin was wanting to, I'll let Dustin get into the details, but to attempt the across the globe run again, and she put us together. And now he's not conned me into it. It's really not much of a con, but
no, knowing you from the stories that you and I've shared in the past episodes, I'm like, it wouldn't have taken too much to kind of dangle that in front of you to make you jump at it.
I'm excited about it. I'm not gonna lie. I'm pretty scared about it still, but yeah, it's so. And Dustin will get into this a lot more, but he's going to run around the globe, and I'm going to follow him or be with him on the bike, biking around the globe.
As support. Yeah, cool. And then one of the other things that that I know that maybe you just take it for granted, but you are a nomad. You're living in your van.
Yeah, so I'm one of those weird homeless people that have this little creepy van, and no. But yeah, I did the van life thing about 3.5 years ago, sold almost all my possessions. And so I just have this little van and kind of travel the country, follow the good weather around, and just play. So yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah. Okay, Dustin. So I don't know you at all, except from what I've kind of seen on Facebook. And I was kind of wondering how you got hooked up with this guy and convinced him to help you. But so tell a little bit about your journey and what how did you get started running and what brought you to this?
Yeah. So I've been running competitively my whole life. Growing up, I did the State Games of America and the Junior Olympics and all of that. And then once I got into high school, even more competitive with cross country and things. And then I was a college athlete. And soon into college, I decided I didn't want to do that anymore. And I went into the military. So I ended up going to the Navy, and I did a few deployments in the Navy all around the world. And as I traveled around the world in the Navy, I got to run in all these really cool places. So once I got out of the Navy, I was suffering really bad from like PTSD and depression. And I stopped running for a long time. I couldn't find happiness in running anymore. So when I got out of the military, it was really hard on me physically and mentally, and I ended up having a house fire, lost all my possessions, burnt completely to the crisps. There was nothing that was left. And that moment in my life is actually what brought running back into my life. One of the only things that survived, was one of my belt buckles from running my first ultra, and it didn't survive. It was completely in a crisp, but you could tell what it was. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I want to get back into it. So I started writing down all the stuff, all my dream list, all the stuff that I really wanted to do again. And on the very top of that list, I'd been following the World Runners Association for years. and an American and still never ran around the world. So as I started writing all these goals down, I always made sure that was number one. And once I got done, I started checking off some of the other ones, but I always wanted to come back to number one. And it was in the beginning of 2019 when I finally decided that I was going to reach out to them, reach out to the Guinness Book of World Records, and I was going to see, well, what does it actually take to run around the world? And how do you certify it? What is the logistics of it? How does this all work? And over the next 6 months, I kind of planned it all and couldn't find a crew member at the time. And I just knew that I needed that space away from the world for a while, get away from everything, rediscover myself again, and do something really awesome all at the same time. So Tom Dennis from the World Runners Association, he's the vice president. Him and I became very acquainted over those 6 months and throughout the whole journey. And now him and I are really good friends. But he kind of guided me through everything. And being I was going to be the first person to ever do it solo, a lot of things became a lot more difficult, being able to verify certain things and the GPSs that were required. But yeah, I left out in May 1st of 2019. And I ran from Missouri to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And then I flew to Lima, Peru. And I ran from there south into Chile through the Atacama Desert over the Andes Mountains, about 20,000 feet in altitude, over to Buenos Aires, flew to Lisbon, ran from Lisbon. One of the rules is you have to hit antipodal points. And Madrid, Spain, and Auckland, New Zealand are exact opposites on the globe. So you leave Lisbon and you have to make sure you hit Madrid. And then I went up and went north into France and Belgium and Germany all the way back down to Istanbul. When I got to Istanbul, there was problems with Australia on fire. And this mm-hmm. was the beginning of 2020, January 2020 by then. And the World Runners Association allowed me to have 2 weeks off, which isn't typically allowed in a row. To see what was going to happen in Australia. Well, then at that point, COVID happened. And then when COVID uh-huh. really hit strong, they sent me home and I went back to Los Angeles and then I ran all the way back to Missouri. So I ended up with about 10,000 miles. I did 35 miles a day, pushing a running stroller with all my supplies in it, sleeping on the side of the road. But unfortunately, the 6 world records that I had left to accomplish, I couldn't because I didn't get Australia. Or New Zealand, which was required for some of their rules.
Okay.
So
it's interesting. And I guess one of the questions I had, and I'm not familiar with, and not this first time I've heard of it. What is the World Runners Association? Is this?
Yeah. So
tell me a little bit about the association.
Yeah. So the World Runners Association is the governing body that was set up to pretty much control the circumnavigations of the globe on foot, in the sense. And it's based out of Australia. Phil Esman is the president. Tom Dennis is the vice president. And right now they say there's only 6 people who's ever fully been certified to have circumnavigated the globe and been able to prove it. So, and that goes down to like GPS tracking. When you get done with the run, you have to send all your devices in and they check them. They make sure that they weren't tampered with. You send all your data in, you send all of that in. But there's a long list of things they require. Mm-hmm. And it got set up in early of 2004 or something, I believe. And what it was is Tom Dennis is an old Olympian. He ran marathons for Australia's team. And he wanted to run around the world. And there'd been a lot of people that said they did it, but no one could really prove that they did it. So he said, we're going to set up. He got with Guinness Books of World Records. The Guinness Book of World Records said they will not certify a circumnavigation because it's impossible due to water. Mm-hmm. So they partnered with the Guinness Book of World Records to create the World Runners Association, saying you can't circumnavigate the globe because of water. But what you can do is run the circumference of the globe on land and then set up rules that apply to that. And a minimum of 3,000 miles on each continent. You have to do 4 of the 6 runnable continents. The reason they did that is obviously there's parts of the Middle East and Africa that are very dangerous. So mm-hmm. it doesn't make sense to force somebody to run there if they really don't have to get the distance in. So they said okay. Four of the six, you have to hit antipodal points, which make sure that you cross the exact opposite on the globe. So you are making a full circle. You know, mm-hmm. whether you cross in a plane, bus, however you transport from one continent to the next continent, you have to hit all lines of longitude. So that way you're going all the way around as well. There's a whole list of things, but early 2000s, they did it, and he did it in 1,000 days. You know, I think he ran 17 or 18 miles a day, and it took him a really long time, and he had a crew member in a car, and they did it very leisurely. Well, it got really competitive after that, but a lot of things can happen. There's been a ton of people try and get 10, 12,000 miles like I did, and then something comes up and they can't finish or they get hurt. But there's never been an American on their record to have done it, and there's only been six that have been certified. So
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So cool. So, and you're doing, that was your first attempt and you had to stop. You're right. Doing this again.
Yes, this time. And this is where Brian is going to be a lifesaver. Is I won't have to push that 100-pound, you know, cart with all the water and the food and everything like that. Brian will be able to help us out, but yeah, we'll go for the first American again, and we'll go for the youngest in the world, and we'll go for the fastest circumnavigation. We're really looking to average about 45 miles a day. Some days will be a little bit more. Some days will be a little bit less. I haven't really advertised it, but we're going to go for a few Guinness Book of World Records, like the most consecutive days running a marathon in a row, the most consecutive days running an ultra marathon. A few of those will be sprinkled in. But yeah, we're going to go for a second time. We'll go for a very similar route. That we did last time. I know it very well. I went to a lot of those spots in the military and then obviously with the last world run. But it'll be a whole new world for Brian, and he'll get to experience
yeah. a lot. I haven't been out of North America. I've been to Mexico and a couple of Caribbean countries. So I'm really excited yeah. for it.
Wow. Wow.
It's incredible. But
yeah, go ahead. No, I was going to ask about what do you have to take with you? I mean, tell a little bit about yes. what you took before, so, and what your plans are for the second try.
Yeah, so the first time I had loaded down everything that I thought I would have needed, and just packed everything in. You know, obviously all the basics, your tent, your sleeping bag, but anything and everything that I could possibly think of, I tried to slam into this double-seater toddler stroller, but I very quickly got my feelings hurt going into South America. Lima, Peru only allows you to fly in with a certain amount of luggage, one suitcase and like a bicycle, for example. So I had to cut my gear list in half very fast. So like wow. for the first month when I was down there, I didn't have a tent. So I just slept in a sleeping bag on the side of the road somewhere. You need a water filtration system. Obviously, you need running shoes. Depending on where you're going to be in the world, obviously depends on a lot of your gear too. Like you cross the Atacama Desert, you don't really need a lot. It's just super, super dry. So you just need to pack in as much water as possible. You cross the Andes Mountains at 20,000 feet. You need to make sure you have all the appropriate cold weather gear needed. You know, you go through the Amazon rainforest a little bit, humidity is really high, a lot of rain. And really you got to protect yourself, which I wasn't aware of last time, but this time we'll be a lot more aware of is some of the animals. You know, packs of little dogs or jaguars, or the locals will tell you about pumas and stuff, but I definitely had packs of dogs outside my tent. I've got it on camera. I was stalked by a jaguar for a couple of nights when I was down there. I had a huge, massive snake strike at me a few times when I was down there. So the gear ranges depending on where you're going to be and what you're going to be doing. And the locals will help out more than anything because they're very knowledgeable about the time of the year and the animals that are around and what's ahead. You know, I got caught going into the Atacama Desert really unprepared last time. And a lot of the locals helped me with water. I was getting ready to run out of water. I had very little left, and I had a lot of locals that would drive by going from one town to the next town because they're very, very spread apart down there. That helped me out. But the locals are very crucial. And then in Europe, it rained on me every day but 3 days for 3 months straight. I got rained on at any given point all throughout Europe. So the rain gear was a must. And I was there during Christmas, so that was actually really cool. But
wow, Europe and Christmas. Now, I just think that would be cold.
It doesn't. It didn't snow on me hardly at all, but the rain is freezing. The rain is so cold, especially in Germany. Once you get way up there, you get past the Pyrenees Mountains, it gets really cold with the rain. The couple of days I had without rain, it wasn't that bad. But the rain was cold. So
this time you've got Brian, you're going to be riding a bicycle with the gear. Is that?
Yeah. So I'll have the gear that he has, and I'll have the gear that I'm carrying. And, we're kind of leaning towards, we've texted a few times about this, but either I'll have what's called panniers, which are like saddlebags on the rear tires and the front tires. Or more likely, I'm kind of leaning toward, and I think Dustin too, is getting a little tow behind trailer. Mm-hmm. We can get a little more stuff in there. I think it'll just be logistically a little bit easier. I think the only real downside would be you've got either one or two more tires that have a chance to go flat. But
right.
I think it'll be worth it.
The tires are a huge thing.
Yeah.
So. I had tons of flat tires.
Did you? Okay. Yeah.
A lot.
You had tons of flat tires on your.
You get into Argentina, like those sticker burrs that you see in like the deserty areas, those are all over Argentina. But when you get down there, you can get solid rubber tires. So they don't take air, they're just solid rubber. But tons of tires.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What? Yeah, solid rubber, that doesn't sound like it'd be a lot of fun on a bicycle.
No.
Well, I think he's talking about for the trailer.
For the trailer,
Yeah. So it'll be tough pushing that, because I'd imagine some of that stuff's going to be steep enough that I'm going to be pushing the bike rather than pedaling it. So I've just been trying to get in shape, get my legs stronger, and of course, I'll have the easy part on the flats and the downhills.
On the flats and downhills, yeah.
Yep.
Well, and I mean, do you have to stay, you know, right with him? I mean, because I'm thinking if you're running, and if I remember it, you said you're trying to maintain a 14-minute mile pace. I could see if Brian's trying to go uphill pushing a bike, he may not be able to keep that pace.
Yeah, the 14 minutes a mile, I'm really just trying to maintain 45 miles a day.
Okay.
Without pushing the stroller, typically like during training run right now, I can average about a 9-minute mile pace pretty easy for quite a while. So I'll do a 9 or a 10 for as long, and there'll be a lot of walking up hills and things like that. But I'm not as worried or concerned about the minutes a mile. Cause some days they'll be fast. Some days they'll be really slow. Some days, like, it'll mostly be walked like Paso Hama down when we're crossing the mountains, because it's so steep. So the minutes a mile is not a huge thing, but 45 miles a day. And what that'll really look like for us is, you know, Brian doesn't have to get up super early in the morning and get out on the road when I do, cause I'll be able to get quite a few miles in before I'll ever need anything. And so it's all about just, you know, getting up, getting everything packed up, kind of moving on throughout the day. If we need supplies, maybe he can go up ahead and get some things or prepare some things for us, or towards later in the day, you know, and I'm sure we'll stop and have lunch together and hang out a little bit. And then once we get back on the road, if I got 10 miles left and, you know, Brian wants to go ahead and go get camp set up or get something started and just kind of relax, he'll be able to do that. So it won't be as much about always being beside each other, but I'm sure there will be a ton of time where we're both walking or we're both just hanging out or anything. So I think it'll be an equal amount of together and then kind of doing our own thing.
Right. Yeah. Good.
I think it'll, you know, I think our habits will probably change and adapt, and we'll figure out what works the best for both of us. But kind of in my mind, I kind of see it like on the steeper uphills, he'll get ahead of me. And then once I get to the top of the hill, you know, I'll probably bomb the downhill and, you know, 20 miles an hour or whatever, then wait for him. I, you know, I'll have the luxury of being able to get ahead of him a little bit and take a break, or like he said, you know, set up camp or go into town mm-hmm. and get us restocked on water or whatever it may be.
Right.
But, so yeah, we'll get it worked out. We both know that we're not going to be side by side for the entire trip. So yeah.
Right. And each continent will serve each other differently as well. South America, with everything being very spread out, and even just the simple things like grocery stores being so different, it'll be a lot different. We'll go from South America being very alone, very isolated, very few and far between, to where Europe, you're going to hit little villages every 5 to 10 miles. And that'll be a lot different. So each continent will even serve both of us a little differently. Mm-hmm. So I think the same game plan we would have in South America will change for Europe. And then it'll change even more drastically in Australia. And then in America, it's so different. It was actually the worst continent that I ran in, as far as how people treat you and the supplies and just the people around you. Because when you go to foreign countries, people find out what you're doing and they want to help, or they're like, whoa, that's crazy. And then in America, it's like, man, nobody cares. Like, get out of our way. So every continent will be a little different.
Well, that's sad to hear that about our own country. But
my second day on the road in America, I had somebody throw a 44-ounce soda on top of my head when I was going over a bridge. The second day.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, if it had a lid and was sealed up tight and didn't spill all over the place, that might have been a good thing.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It's like they were trying to help you out.
Yeah.
Well, and I guess I'll ask Brian, you know, you've done some traveling in America, and I mean, with you know, what people call trail angels and river angels, you know, there are people out there who are in the United States that are willing to help.
Yeah, and Dustin said he got a ton of that during his 2019-2020 trek. So yeah, it'd be nice if we get it again. Yeah,
yeah. South America is phenomenal with people wanting to help, because they understand what it's like to have so little that when somebody comes in and they look like they need stuff, it's almost overwhelming at times how much they want to help.
Mm-hmm. See, Dustin, one thing I was thinking about earlier is I wonder if we're not together, you're going to look this time, you're going to look just more like a runner who's out running for 5-10 miles without that cart. I wonder if you're going to get as many people saying, hey, what's this guy doing? Because you're going to look more like a, you know, a morning jogger who's out for a little 3-mile run.
I agree. In Europe, that's definitely how it'll look. But in South America, tall, skinny, white guy out running in the middle of nowhere, people are going to want to know. And in Europe, very much. But honestly, you get outside the major cities in Europe, and I think it'll kind of still be like, what's this guy doing?
Yeah.
Because you get in those small villages, you know, you get outside Paris or Bordeaux or Madrid, you don't have a ton of people exercising all the time. You do in the big cities, but not in those small villages. So those small villages will still pretty be welcoming, open armed, but the big cities, they weren't either way. You know, they either thought you were homeless or you were an athlete or whatever, but
yeah.
Well, and I would imagine, Brian, that you would attract attention too. I mean, a bicycle
I will,
loaded
because
down
I'll
with
have
gear.
That trailer or all the panniers on there. So they'll mm-hmm. kind of know I'm doing something long distance, I think.
Yeah. And we'll have a small sign that'll go, which once we figure out how we're going to pull the gear, whether you'll have the trailer or you won't, we'll have a small sign that'll kind of say what we're doing and where they can follow us, or if they want to contribute anything, where they can go and do that. So
yeah,
Brian will get quite a bit of attention from that as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I have seen bicycle. I did some bicycle working on bicycle. I was had a idea of traveling with bicycle, and my plan was to have both panniers and a trailer. So
oh, okay, yeah.
So that I mean,
and it could be that. Right. Yeah. It could be.
Yeah. I'm really hoping that. I was just going to say, I should preface that I am a beginner. I have never done, you know, I've done backpacking and I've done this kayak trip, but I had never done a bike packing trip. So I may say some stupid things on here, but I'll learn quick.
No, and that's the thing. I think once we meet up and do some training kind of together and get things going, we'll see what'll work and how much gear we may or may not need. And it may be like in Europe where we don't need the trailer because we have supplies everywhere. And then South America, we may need the trailer. I think it'll just kind of be hit and miss, but we won't really know until we get together and work it out.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. So when you need something that you don't have, or you have something that you don't need, what happens?
We break into a store late at night and rob. Just kidding.
What I did on the last journey was if I had gear I no longer needed, I would trade it. So if I had a big winter coat that maybe I didn't need anymore, I would go to a village, find a store or somewhere, not like a shopping mall, but more of like that mom and pop store. And I would see if they would be willing to trade it for something I could use. And I could almost always find someone willing to trade. I know I traded gloves that I crossed the mountain in for food because I was so hungry and they didn't really have anything else, but the guy really wanted my gloves. And I was like, well, you can buy me a meal and I'll give you the gloves. And we did it like that. And as far as getting gear that we don't have, that's hard because in South America, it's very hard to get gear and they don't have a lot of those places to be able to get all the stuff that you need. So if you're underprepared, most of the time we'll just have to do with what we can.
Well, and will you go back to Lima, Peru again and risk losing half your stuff?
Well, we will. Because I know what to bring now, what not to bring, what I should have brought, what I didn't need to bring. And then between Brian and I both being able to take one baggage plus his bicycle, I kind of feel like I know how to finagle that, you know, 100 pounds worth of gear in two bags in the sense and make it work for us and how we need it to, because I know I've been to Lima 7 times. I know what we can buy in Lima and where we can get it and what we can't. Like, sleeping bags you can buy, you can't buy a tent, and that's how they prevent homelessness. So there's a lot of things like that. And then I have a really good friend that lives in Arequipa, Peru, which will take us about 20 days to get to, but he'll be able to have almost anything that we do need there. So anything that we can't take, we'll send to him, or we'll order it or something and get it sent to his house. He's a professor at the university there, and his name is Ryan, and he'll take care of us.
That's good. It's good to have a local contact. Well, one of the other questions that kind of was running around in the back of my mind is, what about languages? I mean, because you're going to be going through a lot of different countries, and how do you communicate?
Brian and I both speak a little bit of Spanish.
Un poco.
I don't claim to be great. In most situations, I can figure out what people are saying. But once you get in Europe, all of Western Europe speaks English. You know, you can always find somebody in Portugal, Spain, France, Belgium, Germany that speaks English. Once you get on the Eastern side, cell phone.
Google Translate.
Yeah, because, well, there's an app that will download. It's like $10. And it has every language we'll need, but the whole eastern side of Europe, very few people speak English, and their languages are so crazy, I don't even bother trying to figure it out. But a few places you get into, like Romania, they're very impatient. They don't really care what you have to say. They're not going to take the time for you to type out your message and show it to them and see if you can translate it back and forth. But there's like Turkey, very open, very welcoming. Hungary, huge place that loves Americans. So they're just a big party country, to be honest, but they'll take the time and do it. So it's hit and miss. It's hit and miss.
Cool. So, and you are doing this as a way to raise money and awareness for military veteran suicides.
The First World Run was for veteran suicide awareness. I am a suicide attempt survivor. After my house fire and with my PTSD, I attempted to take my life, and the doctors were able to save me. So the First World Run was for that. The Second World Run, which I'm calling the Redemption Run, it's 50-50. So 50% is going to Stop Soldier Suicide, which is a veteran suicide awareness organization out of North Carolina. Phenomenal organization. And then the other 50% is going to an organization, which I can't say the name just yet because I'm still getting approval from them. But what they do is they help with homeless veterans in getting them tiny houses.
Okay.
So they work with that. The veteran will actually has to build his own tiny house. So they'll send a team and the veterans will help. We'll get help, but they get the satisfaction of like building their own house. They're like 320 square feet, I think. But I've partnered with that organization as well. So,
Okay. And you have a wood shop. I mean, that's kind of a little bit into your wheelhouse. So.
Yeah. Well, we do. Yeah. I own Workshop 22 and we do a little bit of everything. We make everything that would be on the inside or outside of your house, home decor, furniture. I'm doing a few big metal sculptures right now. We do a little bit of it all. And we have a whole wood shop that's free for veterans to come use. And we have a veterans food and clothing pantry and things like that as well.
So, and I'll have your GoFundMe page. I will list that in the show notes as well. So, and I'll ask you to mention that before we, how people can get a hold of you before we wrap up.
Yeah.
So in preparation for this, I mean, I know Brian says you're riding a lot. What is your kind of planning and training look like?
Yeah. I'm just now getting into the phase of training where I'm going to be getting back into the weight room and doing light weights and resistance training. I just got off of like the long run side of training. I was doing about 10 in the morning and then another 10 at night. So I'll do probably till the first of the year. I'll get off of the running, get more into light weights and resistance training. And then once we get back into January, we'll ramp back up. I'd like to do about 25 to 30 miles a day throughout January. February, I'd like to get into the 30 to 35 miles. And then March, I'll dial it back down to just about 10 miles a day. And then in April, we would be looking at leaving.
Okay. Now, and you guys have never met in person, is that?
No. We have not.
Is that?
Nope, not yet.
We've talked on the phone and we've texted and Facebook, but yeah, this is kind of like meeting them for the first time.
Right.
So what are you going to be doing together? I mean, you're going to do some shakedown times together.
And I should tell you this, Dustin, I'm probably going to leave. I'm in Phoenix, Arizona right now, but I think tomorrow or the next day I'm from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Dustin's from the St. Louis area. So I am heading that back that way here in a couple of days. So,
yeah,
we may be able to get together and fine tune some stuff.
Yeah, I'm about an hour and a half south of St. Louis. But anytime after the first of the year, I would say we don't need a ton of time because, to be honest, the first stint from Missouri to whether it'll be South Carolina, I may reroute it to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, because you got to fly out of Fort Lauderdale anyways. So just not have to worry about this, that layover flight. But depending on how that gets rerouted, that whole first 20 to 25 days there, that's training. You know, that's getting the kinks out in a familiar place. Anything goes wrong, at least we're here in the United States. So really, before we leave, we really only need maybe 3, 4, 5 days of just going over some gear listings, figuring out what would work for him and what he's comfortable in having gear-wise, what he may be comfortable in not having. And then same for myself, talking in person about just kind of what every day would look like, and just a couple of days to just kind of go over it all. Yeah. We don't have to go do a big 50-mile day, because we're gonna have plenty of that. And I really don't want to get burnt out before we leave again. I understand what it's like to be 10,000 miles deep in a run, and you know, I always tell everybody there's no such thing as motivation. You know, it's just a lack of discipline. And I really don't want to demotivate in this sense before we go. I don't want to get worked up way too much and do way too many big days together, and we get out there and then it's nothing like what we were working out. So those days will come, just a couple of days to get familiar with each other, and we'll be fine.
Yep.
So what do each of you do? I mean, you've both run, you know, trail races, and yep. Dustin, you've run some ultra marathons. What is your, you know, kind of your strategy for, you know, getting through those times when things don't necessarily go as what you want? I mean, what kind of mental preparations do you do for that?
Good, Brian.
How do you deal with those?
Well, for me, I go into these adventures just, I don't know. I talk myself into it's just gonna suck every single day.
You say that to begin with?
Well, yeah. I mean, I just prepare myself to, you know, I'm not going in with illusions of grandeur that every day we're gonna see miraculous sights and I'm gonna feel great. So, you know, I go in with a very pessimistic attitude, and then when I do see the great things, the amazing things, you know, it's just icing on the cake. And you know, my two little, well, they're not little adventures, but compared to what Dustin did, it's little, is, you know, it just, it's a routine. It's just like going to work every day. You know, you wake up and some days you're looking forward to going to work. Other days you're going, oh God, do I got to go into work again? And it's like that for me. And I'm going to have a little bit of a benefit over Dustin is that he's been to all these places except for Australia and New Zealand. But every single thing I see is going to be new and exciting to me. So,
mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. And I've been to Australia in that, when I was in the military, but I agree. You're going to have that whoa feeling a lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah.
For me, like I said, I don't believe in the word motivation. And I believe it's just getting up every day and doing it. But one of the things I do that I'm very strong about in my training is I don't listen to music. I believe music can be a crutch. Very cliche, I know, but it allows me that when the training gets hard or the day is hard, I don't lean on something else like, oh, I don't have my music today. I can't get through it mentally, you know? So when I'm out there and I'm doing something and it really is bad, then it's easy for me to get through it with no music, but then every now and then you can kick the music on and it's like, oh, okay, well, this becomes so much easier now because I train mm-hmm. with no music. And yeah. For me, it's not music. When I was on the last world run, during the super bad days, like climbing the mountain, I think when I finally did the 20,000 feet, I did 4 miles that day. Cause it's such thin oxygen and I was pushing that big stroller and I was pushing it backwards. I was walking backwards cause my legs were shot. I listened to audiobooks. So I didn't listen to mm-hmm. music. I turned audiobooks on that day and just went to work. But as far as for training, I don't do any of that.
Okay. Okay. 20,000 feet. I mean, what you said you made 4 miles. So I would think 20,000 feet would be difficult to spend, you know, spend time in that environment.
Yeah. So, I've got some videos and stuff on the last one, and you can just see like my face is dark purple and my lips are almost black. And, I remember taking out my camera and just being like, this sucks, and talking into the video and saying like, I got to sit down, I'm lightheaded. And, but believe it or not, on that Facebook page, there's a video and a couple photos of a red fox, and I have a red fox tattooed on my right arm. It always symbolized my twin brother. So when I got up there about 19,000 feet, everything's just awful. You know, I'm just a couple miles in and this little red fox comes up to me. I open a can of tuna. I pour it out. I've got hardly any food. Felt like I was delusional at the time. And honestly, I think that one event is what helped me get fully over the mountain passage and back down the other side. I truly believe that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool.
That, and once I got on the other side to customs at a back down about 15,000 feet, I drank about 12 cups of coffee. That helped too.
So besides the lack of oxygen, it's cold, I would imagine.
It's freezing. And that's the point. That's the reason that Brian and I have to leave at a certain time period here. We want to hit the Andes Mountains when it's summer in the mountains. Mm-hmm. So it'll be winter there. So we'll be pushing about 55 to 60 degrees most days, which is perfect weather in my opinion, just so that we can cross the mountains when it's summer in the mountains. So that is crucial because it'll be negative 10, negative 15 degrees during the day, negative 20, negative 25 at night, but there won't be any precipitation. So it'll just be cold. There'll be some wind. The wind will be brutal. I think at one point I had a scarf wrapped around my whole head and face, but there won't be any
negative 20, negative 25.
Yes. So I have several recordings, on my phone.
Yeah, I know that. I was wondering if that was centigrade. Yeah.
No. And, yeah. So it gets really cold, and that's what we're battling, but we're battling it with no precipitation, which is key. Because if we were there in summer in the mountains, it's still super cold, but it snows and ice, or winter in the mountains, it snows and ices and freezes, and we don't want that.
Okay. And so summer in the mountains, that would be wintertime. You're on the other side of the equator, is that right?
Right, other side of the equator.
Yeah, so it would be wintertime in the United States.
Well, so it'll be summertime in the United States, wintertime in South America, but due to the altitude, it'll actually be what they call mountain summer.
Mountain summer, okay. So yeah, I was trying to connect all those because I thought I was missing something.
No, so it'll be winter in South America. Ironically, we'll hit winter in South America, then winter in Europe, and then probably winter in Australia. And it's all strategical, you know. North America, I don't really mind. I can run in any weather; it doesn't really bother me. We don't have anything major to overcome necessarily here. In South America, we want winter so that it's summer in the mountains. Europe, by default, is going to be winter. The hardest passage there will be the Pyrenees, but they're really not that bad. And the reason being for that is because we want winter in Australia so that when we pass through the nebular, it's not 130 degrees in the middle of the outback just smoking us.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. So it's all strategical. It took, like I said, it took me about 6 months the first time of every single day on the computer, looking at maps, looking at weather forecasts, talking to Tom Dennis at the World Runners Association. Tony Magnin is my ultra running mentor. He held the world record for like the 24-hour treadmill and the 48-hour treadmill for a long time. And he used to run for Ireland professionally. And we're just working with all those guys. It took 6 months to plan the route, the safest with the right passages in the right zones, in the right weather. It took a long time to get it all down.
Now, You said you'll be one of a handful who have done this, yeah. And the only American.
Correct.
The only American. Youngest American, right? Or the youngest person.
And the youngest person. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So, yeah, so I'll be the goal is just for the World Runners Association, the first American, the youngest in the world, and then the fastest in the world. Mm-hmm. And then with Guinness Book of World Records, there's a few others, like the most consecutive days for the marathon and the ultra marathon. And there's a few things in there, but I'm not as concentrating on the Guinness Book of sides. Just the circumnavigation and being the first American and the youngest is what really really brings me to it.
Yeah, and I've kind of wondered if the other people had chosen their own routes, or is the route fairly similar between the people who've done it before?
So Tony Magnan from Ireland is really the only one that did his own route. The other four people, the routes may not be identical, but they're very similar. It's kind of the reason the routes get set up the way they do. You have free roam to go wherever you want. You have to maintain the rules that it talks about, maintaining eastwardly movement. So you have to make sure that you're not snaking back westward and things like that. You can go north and south. You just have to maintain your eastwardly movement. You got free roam, but South America, it's really the best route for South America if you've seen it. Europe, you can kind of go where you need to go, but you have to hit a minimum of 3,000 miles on the continent. So that ilm that takes place is kind of what helps create that 3,000 miles. And mm-hmm. And Australia makes sense that you're running the most southern part because it's the most populated, but no one wants to run directly through, you know, the outback and deal with all of that. We'll have 300 miles of the Nebular, which is the outback, which is more than enough for me. I don't want any more than that. And so the routes are pretty simple. North America, I'll be the only one that does the North America route the way that we do, just simply because we're from America, and you know, our start and finish point is a lot different than anyone else's. Most people start up in like Anchorage, Alaska, and they run to Florida, or they run to like New York City. There was one guy who did San Diego to like Quebec or something. But pretty much most everybody does the same routes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would imagine that somebody would have found the most efficient, you know, fairly efficient way. Yeah, that
right. And there's been a lot of people try. You know, I think between when I was forced to come home from COVID and the wildfires in the beginning of 2020, there was four or five other people that all failed out from around the world from then to now. You know, so there always seems like there's somebody trying. But it just, something always comes up, or accidents or tragedies or, you know, injuries or something.
There's
so
a lot that can go wrong.
Right. It's a long time. It's
a long time. Well, and, you know, ultra runners say that there's a lot of things that go wrong in a 100-mile race. Right. And right. So you're right. going to be doing that many times over.
Yeah. Yep. And, I mean, a lot of injuries happened the last time. Well, a lot of potential injuries, very few injuries, but you know, I got hit by a car last time. I was in Germany and it was really icy and it slid off the road and it bumped me into a ditch and I was pretty sore and I had to take a couple days off. And I mean, just all kinds of things like that can happen that can very easily permanently send you home. But in my mind, you know, and I'm sure Brian will kind of work the same ways, as long as it's not broken bones or something major, it's always something that can be worked through.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do a mile or two in a day, just to maintain those consecutive days and make sure I'm making myself move forward, and then kind of take the day off after that to recover. I was in South America and hadn't seen a town in like 14 days. And I finally get to this town and there's a lemonade stand on the side of the road serving fresh fruit water. And I remember running over there and being like, yes, like I finally get something good. And it made me super sick because I was so excited about what was happening. I didn't use my water filter and it was dirty water and I cramped super bad and I threw up all over the place. and things like that happen, but it's all about just moving forward. And but really looking back at it, it's part of the journey and it what makes it what it is.
Mm-hmm. You remember the bad times more than you remember when everything's going right. So it makes for good,
that is true.
Bad crap makes for good memories.
Yes. That is yeah,
type yeah. 2 fun.
Type 2 fun. And we, as far as, I mean, you're running that far. I mean, how does your body hold up? I mean, do you, is there any kind of, I mean, obviously you've done this before.
Right.
You know, a lot of runners face injuries just in training, yeah. And you're going to be out there doing this every day. So what's your experience with?
Yeah. So I lost 35 pounds on the last run. So I definitely have to, kind of beef up a little bit and not necessarily muscle, but just weight. So that way the body is able to kind of burn stuff slowly as it needs excess for whatever days are going on. I remember, I was 8 or 9,000 miles in and I remember taking my shirt off and it was really the first time I seen a full bodied mirror and just being like, whoa, like I'm shredded. And I didn't realize that I'm 6'3" and I was probably weighing 155 pounds, you know? So I had mm-hmm. lost almost all my body fat, all my water weight. So putting on weight before the run is huge. Putting on something, whether it's mm-hmm. muscle.
What a lot of backpackers, like if you do a long trail, to avoid looking like an Ethiopian when you finish, what the strategy for a lot of backpackers would be to just carry a bottle of olive oil and add it to every single meal, because oil has the most calories
yeah.
per weight of any food out there. Luckily with my beer gut, you can't see my gut, which hopefully will be gone a little bit. Hopefully I won't have to worry about that as much as Dustin did.
I mean, it's hard to explain, but you know, grocery stores they're not like they are here in America. You know, we get to South America, Brian, you're going to realize you go to a grocery store, the only thing you can get is stuff to take home. There's no such yep. thing as pre-made meals and, yep. Olive oil probably costs $35 a container. And, yeah, it's really expensive down there. And, you just eat what you can, anything and everything. And that's what I think that was one of the biggest things that happened to me on the first world run, was eating things I didn't like to the point of it didn't really bother me anymore. The only two foods I know I won't eat is chocolate and tomatoes. Just really not big chocolate or tomato fan. Other than that, it could be a live squid arm on the table moving around and I'm probably going to eat it.
So. Chocolate and tomatoes. That's an interesting,
yeah.
a no-go list.
That's it. I mean, I've had some strange things, both in the military and on the world run. And those are really the only two things I won't eat.
So, yeah. And so I would imagine you'd have, you know, in South America, it would be a lot of plant-based food. I mean, not probably protein would be kind of scarce.
A lot of potatoes. We'll be able to find potatoes super easy. I ate tons and tons of potatoes when I was down there. Fish will become pretty easy to come by. But yeah, it'll be a very vegetarian-based dietary restriction, I guess you could put it, if you wanted to summarize it as that, when we're down there. And I'm okay with that. I'm a big veggies eater, love veggies. And we'll just have to make sure that we grab, you know, little cans of tuna if we can find it, or they don't sell beef jerky, or I'd say beef jerky, but just little things to carry that extra protein. But it'll be mm-hmm. a lot of vegetables.
Yeah, I know that, you know, here in the United States, we eat a lot of meat, but I know that other places in the world, it's much more vegetarian or vegetables or grains.
Yeah, it's very pescatarian, very, very pescatarian okay. down there. I mean, very little beef, very little pork, but a ton of fish and a lot of vegetables. So, and I'm fine with that. I think Brian's pretty okay with that too. So,
yeah, well, I mean, If that's the only food you have, I mean you like yeah. what you said, you kind of eat, you kind of eat what's available,
right? Yeah,
and Go ahead. I was gonna change the subject. Brian, you're new to bicycling. How have you been conditioning your hands and your backside?
So my butt and my back have been good. I've been riding between 30 and 50 miles every other day for the last couple of months, and I'm doing my training on this cheap little mountain bike, which I hope to you know, to find something or maybe even get a sponsor to help me get something that'll be a little bit more comfortable than this mountain bike. But yeah, my butt and my back have been fine. So far, the only thing has been is my hands falling asleep, gripping the steering wheel. See, I told you I was gonna get it. I call the steering wheel handlebars. So yeah, my body, but you know, I'm only carrying the weight that I would carry. So I haven't done any training with a trailer or with the extra weight that Dustin will be carrying. So I still have a ways to go on my training, but so far it's been going great. Real good.
Do you know what kind of bicycle you're going to look at for the track? I mean, I know you had a discussion with that on Facebook about.
Yeah. So I've had a couple of people tell me that I really need, I mean, I could do it in any bike. I mean, you don't have to have the best equipment to do any of this stuff, but as far as like the most practical, the most comfortable, probably half the people are telling me a touring bike, which is made for long distances. And the other half are telling me a gravel bike. And I really don't know enough about bikes to really know, you know, and you really don't know till you get out and you do 800 miles on a bike. So yeah, I'm not sure.
Well, and I imagine some of the roads will not be paved.
That's a good question. I'm glad you brought that up, Dustin.
Many roads. South America is actually phenomenal because the only roads we'll traverse in South America are the major highways. Pedestrians are allowed on there, and it's really the only roads that are not dirt in South America. So there'll be massive. There are really only 2 or 4 lane highways, but they have huge shoulders to the road, 8-10 feet shoulders in most areas. So it'll be paved for pretty much all of South America. Where we run into a lot of the problems is Europe. What I'm hoping with that map that I sent you, Brian, is we'll be on a lot of bike paths. Europe is notorious for their bike paths from
paved
one
paved bike paths.
Paved bike paths, but there will be many, many places where we're going in gravel. I would say last year, maybe 20-25% of my days were done on gravel roads. So they're there.
But would you say what, 85-90% of the whole trip? And I know you haven't done all the route in Australia, but what would you say for the whole trip percentage wise is paved, if you had to guess?
I would, from what I've seen, and with Tom Dennis being from Australia, I'm very confident in saying that I think almost all of Australia is paved. Because they're so few and far between on a lot of their big cities going through the outback and stuff. A lot of that, and I'm pretty sure almost all of it from what Tom and I have discussed is paved. New Zealand, from what Tom said, I think a lot of that is going to be a mixture on New Zealand, because we'll be on some main roads and then some kind of back roads, and then we'll be back on a main road and back and forth. But yeah, I would say above 90% for the whole thing though.
Eric, are you a biker? I mean, I know you're mostly a trail runner, but.
Well, I quit running. I didn't start running until I was 60. So I mainly any kind of stuff that I had done, you know, in my 40s and 50s was on a bicycle. And so that was, and it was kind of in spurts. It wasn't doing it consistently, but I did bike across Kansas for 4 years in a row, 2007 to 2011, I think. So they start at Western, you know, the Colorado, Kansas border and, ride east. And, but I had a recumbent bicycle then. Yeah. So it was a lawn chair. If you imagine the Stingray bicycles that you and I may have, Brian and I may have ridden it as a kid in a little 20 inch wheels.
Right.
Set a lawn chair on top of that and, have the pedals up. I mean, it looked really odd, especially as big as I am. My wife told me I just looked like a clown. but it was extremely comfortable. That was kind of my thing. And then I got into mountain biking. So,
okay.
Yeah. Brian, if you go back onto the Facebook page, when I was right before the major mountain cross, I met a couple of individuals from America, like a doctor and the other one worked at Google. You'll be able to see the bikes they used, and they biked all the way across South America.
Okay. Wait, before you crossed what mountain?
The Andes.
The Andes. Okay.
Yeah. All right. I'll send it to you.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I think the biggest thing for me will be, you know, the tire size. And right now I'm thinking I want that hybrid tire, you know, a little bit fatter than a road tire, but skinnier than a typical mountain bike tire.
Right.
I'm guessing that's probably the tire that I want.
Yeah.
Yeah. The bigger the tire, the harder it rolls. I did the Dirty Kanza with, it was not quite a fat tire, but it's 3-inch wide tires. And, it's okay for going slow, but I couldn't pedal it.
Sand and stuff like that. But on a paved road, it's going to slow you down quite a bit. Yeah.
And so, I had advantage going through the mud because, the gravel bikes all were slipping around and I just kind of flowed over it. But it was not a fast ride at all. So.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, that hybrid tire and a gravel bike probably would be a good combination.
You know, another thing that I think is going to be weird is that I think Dustin, you're going to be dressed probably a lot less than I am. I would imagine because you're running, whereas I'm making my own wind. You know, going downhill, and I'm probably not generating as much body heat most of the time. So you're going to be in like a tank top sometimes, and I'm going to be in a heavy jacket. So that'll be interesting.
I agree. I think we'll both be wearing something different most days. Until it gets nighttime, and then we're all going to be bundled up.
Because it'll
be cold. But and you know, with the bike thing, you know, the big speed don't matter. Speed means nothing. No. Just whatever to be comfortable.
And the effort as well. I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. That's the thing. I like the plus size tires, and it worked even on pavement, or gravel. It was really hard to pedal.
I don't think speed is my thing really is, you know, is comfort. You know, I want my bike seat to be where I want it. I want my handlebars, you know, I want to be in a position that, you know, 3 months into the trip, I'm not saying, oh, my back is killing me or, you know, whatever. So,
Yeah, that'll be me. Yeah.
Well, hey, thank you guys for getting together and talking about this adventure. Can people follow you on social media? I know I was kind of surprised, Brian, when you went down the Mississippi, you had the Facebook posts that you had. I was really kind of like, wow, he's out in the middle of nowhere and still posting on social media.
Yeah. I had pretty good cell signal. It was amazing down there. Plus I get in my tent and I'm bored. And what else am I going to do? So,
That's like it for me. Last year I started out with a blog and I ditched it because Facebook was such an easier way to communicate with the world. So
his mom might talk about the Facebook page that your mom
It was called Dustin Johnson's World Record Run, and she started it when I was doing the blog, and she did a phenomenal job upkeeping it, because I could send through my Garmin inReach Mini, I could send her updates on how things were going when I didn't have signal, and then she was able to post everything and keep everybody updated. And that's actually one thing I'm going to be relying on Brian for quite a bit. Is last time the only pictures of anything was when I stopped and took pictures with my cell phone or something I very rarely ever got a picture of with me on anything. So Brian will kind of act as a crew member, but / social media, you know, manager, whatever you want to say, and you'll be very, very crucial in a lot of the keeping everybody updated on the world run page. And right now it's called Dustin Johnson's World Record Run. That name is probably going to change just slightly, but yeah, Dustin Johnson's World Record Run, and we'll keep all the updates. After the first of the year, we'll probably start updating, if not every day, every other day, just start getting people in the habit of getting on the page. Mm-hmm. We've got 6,000 or 7,000 people on there right now, and want to make sure we start getting them, as many of those people back as we can leading up to the run.
And I think the more that we do social media, you know, people enjoy following, but, you know, also hopefully some, you know, this is a pretty expensive trip. You know, this is we're talking air flights, gear, bicycle gear, camping gear. So, you know, if anyone knows any sponsors that might help us out or wants to donate, you know, we're not begging, but we'd appreciate
any help. You know, I've got, hold on, I've got some quick numbers. Just a sec. All right. So I'm not the technologically savvy guy, you know, but I keep massive spreadsheets and logs and all of that. So right now I have, just so everyone who's listening and for you guys, and it was something I was going to call you, Brian, and go over, but we're estimating for Brian and I's total flights to be around $12,000. So all the flights combined, about $6,000 a piece. It'll be 5 flights in total, I think, with the most expensive flight being from Istanbul, Turkey to Perth, Australia. And then, you know, you just break it down from there. If you did $10 a day for food, that would be $20 for both of us. We're planning on the 45 miles a day, so we'll be at 1 year gone. And you're looking at $7,000 in food roughly. And it just goes through. A good rough number would be about $35,000 to do the whole trip. And last time, solo, I started with $600 in my pocket. And I made all the money through selling bracelets and t-shirts. And that's how I got a lot of it. And then Stop Soldier Suicide came in and partnered and did a little bit of money. But a vast majority of it came from just t-shirt sales and bracelets. And right now we have the GoFundMe page, and at the workshop, I'm doing a few sculptures and things like that where the proceeds go to the run.
Okay.
But yeah.
I'm just selling my body, and I haven't done too well at it. So
I'm looking at your GoFundMe page, Run Around the World Part 2. Is that it?
That's the right one.
Okay.
Yeah,
I will link that in the show notes.
About $1,000 or something right now. I would be very grateful. $10,000 was shooting a little high on the GoFundMe. The crowdfunding pages like that tend to be very hit and miss. A lot of people like cash donations or meeting in person, or they like buying product where you make it a little bit more expensive, but they get something out of it. But if we could get anywhere near half the crowdfunding on that GoFundMe by the time, you know, we're even like in South America or something, that would help us out a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. So, well, and I'll look forward to getting all of your links and having them in the show notes, and hopefully we'll get some people on board to help with your run. Now the GoFundMe is for your funding the cost of your run, and or some of that going to the suicide prevention as well.
So the way that's working is right now I have everything set up in one bank account. One of my local banks called Dustin Johnson's World Record Run. And whatever's excess, whatever we don't use, we'll slowly start donating throughout it all. So if we get to South America and I have $5,000 budgeted for South America and we use $3,500, we'll donate $1,500.
Okay.
It's what I like doing to help prevent surplus spending. You know, like, oh, we had an extra $1,500. Let's start splurging on stuff. Yeah. You get in really bad habits when things like that start happening and you start eating at places you really shouldn't be eating at all the time, or you start spending more nights in hotels than what you really should be. So a lot of that is Brian and I will work out a budget that works for both of us by continent. And then whatever surplus from each continent gets donated at that point. So once we leave and go to Lisbon, Portugal, we'll donate the surplus of South America to the two organizations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Well, that makes sense. That's
and good, we'll sell good t-shirts while we're gone. We're working on a design for that. We'll sell the bracelets. There's a few things. I've got a ball cap that we're getting ready to work on to potentially do a few things. And then I'm going to get with Brian and hopefully we can, I don't have Instagram. I'm not really an Instagram person, but I'd like to get an Instagram going. So what we have a few things going and we'll make it happen.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you a lot for joining me and, we'll, get your links up and everything. And I look forward to, following you on your journey through the, your social media manager here, Brian.
Yeah.
And Eric, good luck at Bandera. I know you got that coming up.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. That's, I'm hill training. I started on my hill training when I got back from vacation. So
awesome. Yeah. And there's a few things that'll come of the run. Like the last run, I wrote a book called The Long Way Home. We haven't published it yet because the part two is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll figure that out. And then, we haven't even left yet. And it's not something I've even discussed really with Brian, but we already have 10 locations that we'll do public speaking at when we return. Okay. So we'll do some touring and some speaking and stuff too. So yeah.
So you won't take time for public speaking along the way. I would imagine you were going to be too busy focusing on getting your
records. It depends. So, like when I went through Stuttgart, Germany, they threw a massive celebration because I went through during Christmas.
Okay.
So I took 2 days off during Christmas and did a big public speaking event. And there was like 2,000 or 3,000 people that went to it and it was huge. Wow. And then I did a public speaking event in, Bordeaux, France. There was three. I did three public speakings while I was gone. Typically what I would try to schedule is like a short day, like a 20-mile day, something I could get done fairly quick and then get a hostel. We'll stay at hostels more than like a hotel or something because they're cheap. And with being two people, we could get a room together and be dirt cheap, $7 a person or something. But we'll go to the hostel and we'll take showers and eat. We'll do a public speaking at night. So then that way it doesn't really disturb our our run, but but it helps. Like when I went through Stuttgart, somebody stole my GoPro, so the Stuttgart community chipped in and got me a new GoPro and stuff. So there was actually one, I have the beanie around here somewhere, but a used car dealership in Kaiserslautern, Germany, wanted to make a $500 donation if I went and did a small speaking thing in front of his used cars. So none of them there spoke English. I don't know if any of them knew what I was saying. I was there for like maybe 20, 25 minutes. And he gave me a beanie and a $500 check to support it. And then he put it all across social media and hopefully sold a few cars. I don't know.
Yeah, that was the show. Sorry for the sudden just stop. Usually I do better than that. So anyway, thank you for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. I sure have a lot of fun bringing these to you every week. If you do know somebody who might enjoy the show, best compliment you can give me is to send them a link and introduce them to the show. I do enjoy having new listeners and have enjoyed talking with those of you who listen. And speaking of talking with you, I have a place where you can talk back. You can leave an audio message. If you go to ultramindsetpodcast.run, it's .run, not .com. I make that mistake sometimes too. If you go to ultramarathonmindset.run, you can find show notes for this show and all the others. You can also find a way to play the shows online if you don't have a podcast player. And you can find, there's a place there you can leave a voice message. And if you'd like to just talk to me and leave comments, would love to hear your comments. If you have something you'd like to contribute, tell a story about your running adventures, anything that is there that you can leave a voice message. Remember that an ultramarathon mindset is about more than just running. I am an ultramarathon mindset coach, and I do coaching for people who are runners as well as looking for their epic thing in life. And if you'd like to see how coaching might help you with that, send me a DM on Instagram. I am at Eric Dieter, or you can use the link ultramindsetpodcast.run. Leave a voice message, or you can leave a text message there as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. Send me a DM on Instagram. I am at Eric Dieter, or you can use the link ultramindsetpodcast.run. Leave a voice message, or you can leave a text message there as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.